Blog Talk Radio.
Are you ready for more propaganda? Well, you're in the wrong place at the right time. Columbo Chronicles is for critical thinkers. Let's welcome the consumer advocate for justice. Here's the Rose, Rose Columbo.
Hi, everyone. It's the Rose, Rose Columbo right here for you every Wednesday right here on Columbo Chronicles Live. And we have a very exciting guest for you today. He's a returning guest, and he has a room full of killers. That's right, a room full of killers by Preston Rendell, and it is a three-time award-winning author. And this book is fabulous, and it is exciting. It includes all sorts of things, such as the world of boxing and corruption and crime and mafia, money, love, sizzling romance, and the law, or the lawlessness in the Italian neighborhoods back in the day. So he's going to talk to us about his book, and he's going to explain something about his childhood, as well as what caused him to write this fabulous book that he hopes to make into a film one day soon. So on that note, we'll take a little break and we'll be back in just a moment.
Obamasaurus, the new book by Rose M. Colombo, is an updated version of a political satire that reflects the political roadmap of today's world. Written with an Orwellian twist, will humanity survive or suffer depopulation or extinction? Obamasaurus by Rose M. Colombo, available at Amazon.com.
The Justice Club is back on Columbo Chronicles Live Podcast. Join Rose Columbo at noon and find out what tips she will provide in a world of little justice.
Columbo Chronicles Live. Columbo is on their trail. Listen up at Columbo Chronicles Live.
That's right. Listen up to Columbo Chronicles Live. And we're going to enter into the world of authors and experts. And we have a fabulous author today. And his name is Preston Rendell. He is a three-time award-winning writer, and he has written for fitness magazines for the last 20 years. And the magazines include Muscle Make International, Planet Muscle, Natural Physique. His subjects include training, nutrition, historical subjects, interviews, and humorous articles. He took 2 years off to write this current novel, Room Full of Killers. Mr. Rendell has previously written a book called Health Nuts on Cape Cod. In 1964, he owned and operated the third health club in Massachusetts called President City Health Club in Quincy, and the second health club on Cape Cod called Preston's Health Spa in Hyannis. Along the way, he won Mr. USA Natural in Kansas City and placed second in the Mr. Universe Natural in Las Vegas. Preston's a strong advocate for steroid-free sports and would like to think he was a catalyst in the fitness health boom in Massachusetts. He's lived in Boston's Italian North End. He trained and boxed out of New Garden Gym on Friend Street, and the University Gym in the South End. The author currently resides in Cape Cod with his constant companion and their five cats. So let's just get started, and let's say hello to one of my favorite authors, Preston Rendell. Hi, Mr. Former USA. How are you doing today?
Pretty good. How about you?
I'm doing great because we have some really great weather today, believe it or not. We had a lot of rain in Southern California here and a lot of flooding in some areas. And the winds were so strong. Of course, I don't live that far from the ocean. So the winds even stronger. I blew my pots and my plants around, and that did not make me happy. But I got it all cleaned up, and they're starting to look pretty good and blossoming. So I'll just plant more new seeds and new plants, and everything will be great again. And how's it over there in Cape Cod?
For about 3 weeks. My poor cats can't go. They don't go out in the rain.
No, they don't like water. Yeah, I thought it was never going to stop.
Well, yesterday it poured all day, and I said, that must be it, and today it's rained again.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I was so happy to see some sunshine. It was like, yes, God. So, Preston, I'm so excited to have you back because your book is fabulous, Room Full of Killers, and, of course, you would like to have it as a book to film adaptation one day, and maybe your dream will come true. You know, we always have to think positive because it really is a page turner. And why don't you tell our audience a little bit about your childhood, because you became a very big health nut, and you got onto nutrition and the bodybuilding. But what happened to you in your childhood, just to give the audience a little background about your Italian neighborhood you lived in and how you became a skinny little kid who was not that healthy into becoming interested in bodybuilding and in nutrition?
Well, you're right about being skinny. I wasn't a 97-pound weakling. I was a 77-pound weakling.
Wow.
And I was in an oxygen tent all the time. I hardly went to school, and I couldn't run because I just ran out of gas. And meantime, I saw a bodybuilding magazine on a newsstand. I said, "What the heck is that?" And I picked it up and I started reading it, and I bought a set of weights and started training out. I actually asked my father for $30. This was in 57. I asked my father for $30 to send away for this bodybuilding course. And I didn't think he'd given me the money. $30 was a ton of money in 57. He said, okay. So I got it and I went through the whole course. And at the end of that, I bought a set of weights. Because it was the course was freehand stuff, you know, pull-ups, push-ups, and a variety of other things. So I bought a set of weights, and I immersed myself in it. In the first year, I gained almost 100 pounds, and no longer the skinny, sickly kid.
Well, that's amazing that you actually saw that magazine and you actually read the magazine, and then for you to have seen that particular program and ask your dad, that is like a miracle. It's a spiritual thing, in my opinion, because what were your chances of that even happening when here you were in and out of an oxygen tank and skinny little kid of 77 pounds? And, you know, it's really, you might call it a miracle, seriously.
There's a picture of me on my website of me on the beach in a bathing suit. If you don't, if your listeners want to see a skinny kid. And then right beside is a picture of me when I won Mr. USA.
See, you are a role model for kids who maybe, you know, are not that healthy, and, you know, maybe their doctors aren't, you know, giving them this type of information about being healthy and nutrition, because a lot of doctors are not into nutrition, they're only into medication. And so what a wise little boy you were, and so motivated to make yourself healthy. And to work at it, so with all that effort you put into it, that is absolutely an amazing story.
I've turned around a lot I've turned a lot of boys' lives around with a training routine.
See, there was a spiritual connection there. I knew it. I knew I'd find it. And so, but you also got involved in nutrition. Why did you feel that? Because it's only been recently that actually some doctors have been jumping on board about nutrition, and there are more nutritionists today than in the past. So you were ahead of your time, right?
I would believe so, because all the magazines I started buying, bodybuilding magazines, and they all included nutrition articles. So I absorbed it like a sponge. And 20 years later, when I was 25 or so, I wrote for fitness magazines, training and nutrition articles. And I was voted for 3 years the best writer of training and nutrition articles. Because you can work out all you want, but if you eat wrong, you're not going to improve your physique or your strength or your health. You have to eat correctly. Doesn't mean you have to be mm-hmm. a monk and eat everything. You know, you can eat a pizza and ice cream, but you have to be in moderation. So anyway, that's how I get. Nutrition is a very important factor in health and bodybuilding.
And even more today, because you know, there's so many preservatives and chemicals now in the food. Instead of making foods from scratch like they did in the past, you know, mom made food from scratch, grandma made food from scratch, and so you weren't getting all those chemicals. And I think that's why a lot of people are healthier who grew up in those years versus the more modern days when they started putting all these chemicals and preservatives in the drinks and the foods, especially box foods and cereals and sugar and salt and getting you addicted to it. So what do you think about, what about the gyms? What drove you and motivated you to open up the gym?
Well, there wasn't any gyms or health clubs in Massachusetts. In fact, my health club when I opened in Quincy was the first health club in Massachusetts. And there was a lot of health clubs out in California, reading about in the magazines, and I found out there's no health clubs in Massachusetts. So I bought the equipment, I found a location. And we're off to the races. You know, the place was packed. When I went down to the town hall, this is a funny story. When I went down to town hall to get a permit to open, I told them what I was going to do with the health club and this and that, and the woman laughed at me. she called the woman over, like, I don't know, and Mary, she said, Mary, come over and hear this. She said, tell her this. I said, I'm going to open a health club, and I'm going to have equipment, I'm going to advertise, and have people come in and put them on routines, they're going to work out and get routines and. And she left. She said, yeah, right, good luck, and she walked away.
Oh.
I opened up, and we were packed. We were packed. I was straight out crazy. Every 12 hours a day with appointments, people.
Isn't that amazing? People wanted it.
Yeah.
It was something they wanted, and they, you know, and sure. We needed at the time, obviously. That's
this
amazing.
This was 1964.
Yeah. What did it feel like to win Mr. USA and second in Mr. Universe? How did you feel?
I think I got more enemies than friends.
Oh.
People get slammingly jealous.
Mm.
You know?
Yeah, isn't that amazing? You know, a lot of people say that when they start to succeed in life, there's a lot of people who are smiling at you and saying, oh, that's great. But in reality, they're jealous and envious that you would succeed at that. It's amazing, isn't it? Instead of being really happy for those people who make that effort, and you did work hard to become healthy and help other young boys become healthy as well.
I had friends that I grew up with in high school and elementary school, but I felt were my friends, and when I won the Miss USA, they all turned on me. Like, who do you think you are? That's what it was, you know. Jeez.
Yeah, it's amazing that how that happens. And you would think they would be happy for you. Yeah. But there's a lot of people who are unhappy with themselves, and they don't want to make that effort or, you know, take the risk and do the work. You have to do the work, you know, to succeed. You know, and you did it. So tell us, go ahead.
I said I actually overworked. The routine I had was way too extreme. If I had to do it over again, I would have cut my workout in half. A lot of bodybuilders do too much. That's what I found out, including me.
I think become addictive, be a bodybuilder.
I don't know if it's addictive or not, but you got to find out what works for you. And that extended workout that I did work for me, but I didn't have to do that much.
Oh,
and
so you're learning.
And I think I would have.
Yeah,
I was doing, I don't know if you understand sets and reps, but I was doing each body part twice a week, 20 sets per body part, which is way too much. In other words, I was doing chest twice a week, and I was doing 20 sets per workout. And I was doing four or five exercises, five sets each. And I didn't have to do that. So what I'm doing now is not even half of that, and I look almost as good. It's all about diet, you know.
Oh, okay. So let's get into your book, Room Full of Killers, because what made you decide to write this page-turner book, Room Full of Killers?
Yeah, it really is a page-turner. I got people emailing me and sending me, audio recordings telling me how much. I got one guy called me. He said, thank you for writing a book. It's the best book I ever read. I wish there were more writers like you. He went on and on. I said, holy mackerel. And I can get it to you because I put it on a cassette and I can play it for you if you want to hear it. But it's amazing. And what started me and then you find out that nutrition is at least half important in bodybuilding, what you eat.
Mm-hmm. So what motivated you to write the book, though?
Oh, my book. Okay, I was Sonny Liston and Cassius Clay. That's what Muhammad Ali's name was before he had it changed. We're going to have a fight in Boston in 1963 or 4. And I went to see Sonny Liston fight in Quincy. No, it wasn't Quincy, it was in Plymouth. And then I went to see Ali fight in Boston, train in Boston. And I found out they're both making $1 million. And I was as big as Sonny Liston. He was supposed to be a big monster. I said, I'm as big as him. I bet I'm stronger. So I said, I got to get involved in this. And see, and they each getting $1 million. I said, I could deal with that. So I started training in a gym and et cetera, et cetera. And I started telling my female friend here that I live with my experiences in boxing, the real crazy stories, you know. And she's kind of mind-opening, mind-boggling stories. And she said, these are unbelievable. You should record these stories somewhere. She said, I'll write a book. I said, you know, I've been writing for 5 years for these fitness magazines, and they love my writing. Why don't I try it? So I hibernated for 2.5 years. This is a true story. 7 days a week. Let's see, 6 to 8 hours every day, and wrote this book. I come out to 750 pages when I finish it 2.5 years later. And publishers got back to me and said, we can't publish a book that big. It has to be 300 pages. You have to edit it. So I edited it, and I got it down to 535, and that's it. I'm not going to go anymore. So I self-published it because I couldn't get a publisher. And my girlfriend's the one who talked me into it. And I'm getting a ton of good reviews. I'm getting letters from people. Jesus, unbelievable. I had a girl from New Jersey named Eileen Zucato. She said, I got your book and I finished it in a week. She said, I read it when I was doing the laundry. I read it when I was cooking supper. I read it when I was changing my grandson. She said, I couldn't put it down. She said, it's the best book I ever read. And I'm a voracious reader. That's her words. And thanks again for writing. Unbelievable. It's the kind of stuff I'm getting.
That's fantastic, those reviews. And they say a lot about you and about your book and your passion for your writing. And also, I noted that your book is dedicated to anyone who has been bullied, whether male or female. And the people and places and events in the novel are fictional. Any resemblance to any person, place, or events is entirely coincidental. But in reality, there's some real truth always in fiction. So why don't you tell us about your Italian neighborhood you grew up with and your parents and what they thought about your new career as a, as in bodybuilding and in nutrition as you were growing up. How did they react to all of your newfound information and knowledge you were gaining?
Well, my mother died when I was a teenager, and my father was an old school, reserved, very reserved Englishman who didn't have much to say about anything. nothing moved him, you know?
Uh-huh.
But my Italian mother was a scream. Her and her mother brought me up. And it was just manja and food and jokes and good times. And she died young, 27.
That's a good memory.
So anyway, and my grandmother was a scream. So anyway, there's a story where I had a started eating differently, you know. My father questioned it, and I said, well, you know, I'm trying to gain weight. So I was eating at this stage. I was eating 3 pounds of red meat a day.
Wow.
And occasionally 24 eggs.
Wow.
Or more.
Oh, my God.
I went up to 232. Well, you have to eat big to get big. You can't eat.
Wow.
It's an old story. He who eats like a chicken will look like a chicken. You have to eat big to get big. So I'd have a pound of red meat for breakfast. I'd broil it, put apple cider vinegar on it, and knock it down with something. I have the same thing for lunch and the same thing for dinner.
Wow.
And I used to buy a roast and have them grind it up in a hamburger.
Mm-hmm.
And I just make hamburgers like that. So
you
I really put a lot of weight on.
you got up to being a Mr. Universe and Mr. USA, and then you went to see Liston and Muhammad in the training and there and watching them, and so that also encouraged you to write the book as well, because it says that you finally got interested in boxing yourself. So what happened at that point?
Well, at that point, my father and I went into a gym, and there was only one gym in the area, and that was in Boston. So, and where I lived was about 45 minutes away. So my father would, at first, drove me into the gym, and we went in there, worked out, and it was all right. So I got a buddy of mine who was interested too, so he and I went in there about 5 days a week. I think it was closed on weekends, I can't remember. And we went in 5 days a week and trained. They had two big boxing rings, and they had a ton of fighters. A couple of them fought for world titles. One guy, Tom McNeely, fought Floyd Patterson for the title. And Tony DeMarco lived in the North End, and I think he was a welterweight champion back in the 50s. So there was some flavor in there. You know, it was in the gym. It was classy people. But anyway, I went in there for a while and trained and got involved in boxing. Then I got a guy in there who was mob guy, Paul Stivaletta. He's dead now, so I can tell you this. he wanted to set me up with a exhibition with a guy in an outside club that had a ring out in the open, in a Fin and Feather Club, I think it was called, in Norwood. And I was just going to be. She said, "You want to?" This is when I started. I had like two fights, and he said, "You want to fight an exhibition with this guy I'm training? It's just going to be four rounds, and nobody's going to hit hard or, you know, any of that stuff." And he said, "All you do is box and just put on a little show." I said, "Okay." So I went in with my father and my brother and got involved in it. In the first round, the kid came out like a hurricane throwing atom bombs at me. So what the hell is this all about? It's supposed to be an exhibition. And there was news vans from all the Boston TV stations there. And I said, what the hell is this all about? So come to find out, Paul Stivaletta got all the vans and he wanted to take films, and he was going to knock me out because the kid he put in there had like 25 fights and I had like two. And he was supposed to knock me out, and they were going to film it and put it on the show, because that kid was going to turn professional the next week somewhere. I can't remember where. Paul Doyle. And what happened was I knocked him down in the second round. In the third round, I had him hurt. Then I go back to the corner. There's a guy in the corner named Carmine. Paul was supposed to be there. After I knocked this kid down, my trainer went over in his corner. I said, what the hell is this all about? So Carmine says, take it easy, kid, take it easy. Just relax, you only got another round. So I come back for the third, and it's supposed to be over. And it went 4 and 5. And the fifth round was 5 minutes. They were trying to, as they say in the business, drown me. I go, well, they run out of gas, and the guy going to beat me up, you know. Didn't happen, mm-hmm. though. And coming to find out afterwards, Paul was managing that kid. That was his boy. And he was setting me up to get beat up and film it, put it on Boston News, and it didn't happen. So anyway, that was my first wonderful experience of being double-crossed in the boxing game. So I completely severed ties with Paul. And I got another trainer named Johnny Two Ads, who was he was a guy who used to say, look me up in the Yellow Pages under Killer. he had an 80-8 record with 70-something knockouts. I can't remember what. And he was the toughest guy I ever met. And he trained me for a while. And then all it's just so many bad experiences. I just said I had enough disappointment, you know.
So did they pay you for your boxing?
Here's the deal. The guy that was promoting the fights is the guy that pays you. His name was Sam Silverman. And he would sell his mother down the drain for 25 cents. And he very rarely gave a fighter what he's promised to give him or pay you at all. I knew a fighter that got six inches over one eye and 6 inches over the other eye, and he stiffed them. This is in Worcester. I said, I can't believe it, you know. So, but the other thing is, you had to fight for him, because if you fought for someone else, he would blackball you, and you wouldn't fight for him, and he was the biggest promoter in the city.
Wow.
So they tried to kill him once in his house. They shot at him through his kitchen window and didn't get him twice. And he finally got his. They shot him outside of a boxing event. He sipped Johnny Two Heads out of $600. He's a bad person. So it's like, you know, you got to fight for him, but you have to take his dirty deals at the same time and like it. So I didn't have any connections. The guys that make title fights and stuff, they had connections in New York or California, and I didn't have any of those connections.
Did any of these guys belong to, like, the mafia or...
I'm sure that Paul Stillblatter was a mob guy. No question about it. He was mob to the gills.
It would be really hard to go up against them and say, hey, I want my money, right?
Well, Paul was the one who would get my money. So it was Sam Silverman that was the one supposed to pay you. He paid me a couple of times, and he stiffed me once, and I said, that's enough. I'm not going to be used by this guy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all I did. They use you and throw you away.
Yeah, it sounds like all the industries. Abuse you, and then boom. Then they don't pay you, and then they take your knowledge and your abilities, and that's it, you know. And they make the money, and you're out the door.
They got 10 guys to take your place, so they don't care. And
yeah, because they all think they're going to be famous.
Yeah, right.
Did they promise you, like, you were going to be famous, a famous boxer?
No, they said I could do very well, because at that time I was white, and they were looking for a white hope. And I got a big newspaper article. It's the whole page of a sports page in the Framingham News. I knocked this guy out in the first round, and he was a ranked light heavyweight. And I knocked him out in the first round, and they did a big thing about, I'm going to be the new white hope. Big, yeah, right.
New white hope. That's funny. But, you know, that's publicity for you, right?
Yeah.
So I wasn't very hopeful when they stiffed you, though, right?
No, I got the newspaper in my gym in the basement, and it's framed. That's as good as it gets. That was in probably 70-71, something like that.
So did you ever get seriously injured while you were boxing?
No. Most time I got injured was when I was sparring with my manager. Johnny Two Heads. I never got hurt in a fight. Never got any cuts, any broken noses, nothing.
Wow, that's amazing.
Most I got hurt was training with Johnny. He didn't fool around when you sparred. He threw atom bombs.
Wow.
And then the only time I was ever hurt by a punch was by him. I got hit by one of his left hooks. And it dazed me.
Go ahead.
A couple of years later, I improved. I hit him with a shot, and he was about to go down. And after the session, I said, Johnny, I had you. All I had to do was step it up. I could have knocked him out.
Did they ever tell you that, like, you know, we don't want you to knock him out. We don't want you to
when you're not supposed to do that. When you're sparring.
When they what?
When you're sparring in the gym with somebody, you're not trying to knock anybody out. You're trying to sharpen up your skills and et cetera, et cetera. And you're not trying to knock anyone out. But nobody ever approached me to take it easy on this guy or whatever, you know. Once in Providence, they told me to take it easy on a guy. I said, yeah, right. So he'll take my head off. I didn't trust anyone.
Wow. So you were young and you were learning a lot about the world of boxing and how it works for some and not for all. Very few, actually.
Yeah.
So, and so how did you feel about Cassius Clay when you saw him in person training?
Oh, I went to see Liston train in Plymouth, and the place was packed, and they charged, I think it was $5 a head to get in. The place was packed, and everybody's in there in sport coats and dressed really well. This is Sonny Liston. The newspapers played him up as a gangster, a crook, a no good, you know, blah, blah, blah. Then I went to see Cassius Clay fight and train in Boston the next day. And I went, there was like three people in there, maybe five at the most. And he's in there training. He's doing all this loudmouth stuff. I'm going to be the bigger, you know, all that stuff the way he used to do.
Mm-hmm.
And there was nobody there. I said, I can't believe this. So I stood right up to against the ring and watched him spar. That's how close I was. And
wow.
That's something, you know. He smiled at me. I smiled back at him. You know, so we didn't talk. But he didn't impress me. He was a bit like a basketball player then. He was 6'3 or so, and he weighed about 200. That's a basketball player. You know, he didn't have any muscle on him at all. I was much bigger than him. And what he had was speed. You know? But Sonny Liston was just a gorilla. He was training in Plymouth. There was a guy he was sparring with named Amos Big Train Lincoln. Hit him with a left hook that would have knocked out a gorilla or a grizzly bear. And Sonny Liston didn't even... Sonny Liston didn't even blink. Everybody in the audience went, whoa! And he didn't even blink. It was huge, huge left hook. Big noise. Nothing. So the time when he got knocked out in, what the hell was it, Maine, for that little right-hand alley, it was a complete fake. Well, here's the deal on that piece. Your listeners will like this one because it's inside pervy information. Sonny Liston, when he was training for that fight, was staying with my guy that previously managed me, Paul Stivaletta, who's a mob guy. And at this guy's house, Robert Goulet, Sammy Davis Jr. and Dean Martin came to the house to visit Liston. And they had a party one night, and the three of those guys were power drinking and loaded. This is what Paul told me anyway. He said, and Sonny Liston's on the couch trying to sleep. And the three guys have got their arms around each other over their shoulders, and they're singing to him. Can you believe it? And Sonny Liston's laying on the couch listening to him. That's what Paul told me. Yeah,
that's amazing.
Robert Goulet, Dean Martin, who's the third one? Sammy Davis Jr. And they got their arms around their shoulders and they're singing. And Sonny Liston's on the couch looking at him. He's bored and he's trying to get to sleep. So anyway.
That's a great story.
Yeah, about a week or two, 1 or 2 weeks before the fight, I can't remember what it was. Paul told me, Sonny Liston got a phone call from someone, I don't know who, and he stopped training. You're kidding me? She said, no. He said, something's up. I don't know what. And it was that fight in Lewis in Maine when Liston got hit with a little shot in the first round. He fell down like he was shot with a deer rifle. So he took a dive in the first round.
Wow.
And Paul told me 2 weeks before. He said, you get a phone call and he's not training. Something's up. So somebody told me you're not winning this fight. So he took a punch to he took a slap to the cheek and he fell down like it was shot. So.
Yeah. So.
That's what everybody said.
Well, everything seems to be controlled, right?
I had first person information on that. No, Paul was the manager. I mean, he was saying it Paul's house.
Yeah, I think when they want to take people out, they just take them out, you know. They just give you a call or whatever. Send you an email mail, I guess. And that's it, you know. It's amazing, you know, when you're listening to this, when I'm listening to this and the audience listens to it, you know, how different it is on the inside versus what people see on the outside on television and then, you know, in the news and all that and the newspapers.
Oh, yeah.
And
oh, yeah.
Back then it would have been the news. And now, you know, it would have been the internet, but it's all the same. I mean, it's what they want you to see and what they want you to hear. But nobody really knows what's going on behind the scenes and unless you hear these stories, you know, years later about what was really happening.
Absolutely.
And this is all taking place during the time that the mafia was still in control of everything and Vegas and everything, you know. And But Vegas was a lot more fun when they were in control than it is now. It's so different now. I mean, seriously.
I was out both scenarios.
Yeah.
I was out there and was mob, and I was up. I won second in the universe. It was in Vegas, and a whole different attitude out there.
Yeah. And so. I can't even imagine being up on stage and, you know, going from a little skinny kid to Mr. Universe. And, I mean, that's such a great, great story. I mean, seriously. And it's so motivating and such a role model for kids, you know that you can get healthy, you know. And I believe in a higher power and in positive thinking and visualization. But also you have to put the work in, too. Like you did.
Right.
And you have to read and you have to gain the knowledge.
Well,
and you have to follow through.
Most of the guys today are loaded on steroids.
Yeah, that's really sad.
Steroids come in the late 50s, early 60s. When I first started competing, I got blown off about 5 contests. I said, what the hell's going on? And somebody said, oh, they're all taking steroids. I said, what are the steroids? And they explained it to me. I said, oh. I said, maybe I'll take some. So I got a prescription of Dianabol, 5 milligrams. And I took one a day for about 3 weeks and my resting blood pressure was through the roof. And I said, that's enough of that. I stopped.
Seriously. So I know that there was some interesting things going on in the neighborhood with the mafia, too. So I think you have a couple stories about some of the things that were happening in the Italian neighborhood in your book as well. Do you recall any of those?
Well, there was a teenage kid that was breaking into houses, apartments. The North End's all apartments, you know. It's like a huge tenement thing. And they only let, at that time, this was in 66, the only people they let in there were the Italians. And my mother's Italian, so I got in. But somebody was breaking into apartments. And I said, Jesus, it's North End, because the mob runs there's no cops, and you can drive down a little, what the hell's the name of the street? Hanover Street was right in the middle of North End. The mob guys would drive down the middle of the street and stop the car in the middle of the road and go in and get a haircut. You know, and nobody give them a ticket or anything. But anyway, somebody's breaking into apartments and stealing stuff. They found out it was this 14-year-old kid. And he just disappeared.
Really?
I don't know what happened to him. I didn't ask, but he just disappeared.
Wow.
You know, that's one story. Another story is, I got this in my book.
Mm-hmm.
They're after this guy who's working for the mob, and he was skimming. And they got him, and they put him in the... And not, the North End's right on the water. They tied him to the bottom of a pole, the pylons that hold up the walks, these big telephone pole kind of things. They tied him to the bottom of it at low tide. They found him 3 days later.
Oh, my God. Oh, jeez. That's pretty scary.
And he wasn't particularly recognizable because the fish ate his face. And
oh, my goodness. So you were actually in the boxing sport at a time when all of these things were going on, and you were young, and here's, you know, and you're making it to Mr. Universe, Mr. USA, and all of this, and you're wanting to be, of course, you're young, and you want to be, you know, this great boxer, you know, the heavyweight champion or whatever, and your dreams are probably there as well, and then you become disillusioned as you go along, because it's not all that. The illusion that would be in the mind of a young person, or even an older person for that matter. You were in a dangerous area, really, when you think about it, but innocent.
Well, here's a good one for you. There was a guy named James Buster Douglas. He was a fighter. He fought about 1990. Early 90s, he fought Mike Tyson. He knocked him out in Japan. And Tyson was the champion then. And James Buster Douglas was just a guy that Tyson was supposed to walk over. But he didn't. And James Buster Douglas gave Tyson a whipping. He whipped his butt. So in the meantime, he was supposed to get $3 million. James Buster Douglas, and he was on Howard Stern's TV show. He said, how much did he get for that fight? He said, $3 million. He said, I got $100,000. He said, after $3 million, you get $100,000? That's it? He said, yeah. He said, well, the guy that promoted him was Don King, who was the biggest thief in the business. And he deducted this, 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 and this, and gave him $100,000. Can you imagine that?
Oh, yeah, I can imagine it. Trust me, I can imagine it. But it's really shocking because they present the people who are successful as making tons and tons of money, and yet there's all these different things going on behind the scenes where the reality of it is that they don't get as much money as it appears to the public, I would think. What do you think?
But Don King is out of the game, I think. Anybody who signs with him as a promoter is stupid anyway. He's burned so many people. But I think the fighters are making a ton of money now. They have these closed-circuit fights. These guys are getting 10 to 20 million a shot. Can you imagine?
Wow. No, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. There was supposed to be a big fight coming up. Tyson, this fighter who's not really anything, but he self-promoted himself up to challenging some really poor fighters, and he beat him, and he got a lot of publicity, and he got Tyson to sign to fight him sometime in July. And the purse is supposed to be like $15 million each. Can you imagine? Because it's going to be pay-per-view. That's the difference now. It's going to be pay-per-view. In the meantime, these two guys had a friendly sparring session supposedly about a week ago. Tyson hit this guy with a body shot and knocked him out and broke ribs, and the guy is suing Tyson now. I said, can you imagine someone suing a boxer for hitting too hard? That's what he's doing right now. Because he said it was supposed to be just a friendly blah, blah, blah. Tyson gets in there and the bell rings. He just turns animal. He's not the kind of guy that can turn it on and off. You get one gear, that's forward. And he hit him with a body shot and supposedly broke some ribs, and the guy went out. And I can't remember, Jake something. Jake Paul, that's his name, I think. But the fights, this might be publicity, I don't know. Publicity stunt. I don't know, but this guy is, if he's going to fight Tyson, he better get a lot of insurance and take several extra strength Tylenols before he gets in the ring.
It's not funny, but it is funny at the same time.
Oh, he's going to get his ass whipped.
Oh, my God.
Tyson's going to go through him like a buzzsaw. The kid, I've seen him fight, he's got nothing.
Wow. It's amazing, though, you know, how much they get paid now, you know, to compared to the past. You know, it's amazing how much they can get paid now just to get in the ring with somebody. But then again, you know, if you have to be, you know, willing to have your body, you know,
look at it this way.
Or your brain.
When I was fighting, my first fight, I got $40. And that was for a four-rounder. In the meantime, Joe Louis's first fight in the 30s, he got $600. So, who's wrong and who's right, you know? Who's screwing who?
Yeah,
that's the way it was.
Complicated. But when you have so many people, involved, I can see how you have to be so careful, you know, because, you know, everybody is, you know, wanting a piece of the pie, right?
Yep.
And lawsuits cost a lot of money, so then the lawyers end up with percent of it.
Jack Dempsey got beat by Gene Tunney back in the 20s. I think it was 1926 or 1927. Jack Dempsey said to Gene Tunney, he said, get lawyers, he said, because all they're going to do is fight off lawsuits. And that's what will happen, one lawsuit after another.
Yeah, and you know what people don't understand is everybody says, oh, you can just file a lawsuit. Well, filing a lawsuit, number one, costs money. Number two, it costs time and effort, and it can be dragged out for years. It can be dragged out for months or years, and it can be thrown out of court. I mean, so many things can happen, but the only ones that win are the lawyers and the people that, you know, are the litigants. You know, they're not going to, you know, they're not going to be able to do anything if that happens. And it does happen. And where cases get thrown out of court or they get continued and continued and continued. And every time it gets continued, you have to pay more money. And then you pay for the phone calls, you pay for the travel, you pay for everything the lawyer's doing. And people don't realize, you know,
how fast it gets gobbled up.
Pardon?
How'd you like to be in Donald Trump's shoes right now?
Donald Trump has been totally legally abused. I wrote the book Fight Back Legal Abuse, which is what is happening to him. He should have read my book. Fight Back Legal Abuse, which was an award winner, went global. And, of course, talk about corruption with that book. We won't go into that one with what happened. But it's like the boxing that you're talking about. And but anyway, yeah, if he'd have read that book, he would have been aware that there's Justice for Some, S-U-M, and Justice for Some, S-O-M-E, which was Chapter 10 of the book. Justice for Some, S-U-M, with the dollar sign, and S-O-M-E, and that is the truth. And you don't know what that judge is going to do sitting on that bench. And, of course, if you read Jerry Spencer's book, he talks about the white envelope. And so it's just everything is about greed, everything. And I don't care if you're talking about justice, because justice is an illusion in the eyes of the beholder. That's all it is. And if you get some justice, you better just count your blessings. That's all I can say. And then, of course, it's collecting the judgment, too. I mean, you know, they have to be able to collect the judgment. But if Trump had been smart, I don't know if he did or not, but he could have, way before he got into court or into politics, I would seem that allegedly, his lawyer could have advised him that maybe you should put the properties into your trusted loved ones' names and before any of that happened, because once it's in litigation, you can't do that. But then it becomes, before all of that happened, if you're going to go into politics and you're going to be I knew they were going to go after him and try to just bankrupt. They couldn't put him in jail. They were going to bankrupt him.
Worse than that, they're going to go after him right up to the election.
Oh, yeah, that's what it's all about. But I think they also thought that they were going to be able to cause him to be so emotionally, physically, and financially distressed that he would have dropped out. I don't think they thought it was going to go this far, really, internally. And unfortunately, we've run out of time, darn it. Preston Rendell, you are always fantastic to talk to about your book, Room Full of Killers. Please tell our audience where and how they can get your book.
Okay, it was on Amazon. I had some problems with them, so you can now order it from me. Here's the phone number, 508-744-7032, or on my website, which is PrestonsHealthSpa.com. Just shoot me an email and say you want my book. The book
fantastic.
The book's 535 pages, and you won't be able to put it down.
Thank you so much, Preston. God bless you. And I want everybody to go on his website or call him and get Room Full of Killers. It's a page-turner. You will not want to put it down. God bless you, Preston. We'll talk to you again.
Thank you.
You're welcome. You too. Bye. And that's all we have time for, folks. And Preston Rendell has left the building. Room full of killers. You will not put the book down. It is a page-turner.
Obamasaurus, the new book by Rose M. Colombo, is an updated version of a political satire that reflects the political roadmap of today's world. Written with an Orwellian twist, will humanity survive or suffer depopulation or extinction? Obamasaurus by Rose M. Colombo, available at Amazon.com.
Well, my friends, time flies. And now is the time to say goodbye. Thanks so much for being part of the Colombo Chronicles family. You are appreciated. Please do it now. Bookmark. Push that like, share, and follow button. Oh, and don't forget to comment below and stay in touch. Make your family part of the Colombo family. Until next Wednesday at noon, remember, God loves you, and so does the Rose.